most people think. Hello and welcome to episode 43 of What Most People Think. Oh, isn't it hot? It's too hot. That sun is hot. Yeah, the sun is always hot. I mean, the sun has made a career out of being pretty fucking hot. Why are the British people? We're always surprised, aren't we, by heat? It doesn't matter how many days we've seen it coming up on the weather forecast or a little Yahoo thing on our phones. The day that it is actually properly hot, we're like, oh, that's fucking hot. It's too hot. It's a different kind of heat. It's very different. When you go abroad, it's a drier heat. And we have no qualms about, you know, coming out with the exact same cliches that we come out with every year. It's, you know, it's just, I don't mind it. It's the humidity. Oh, yeah, it's the humidity. And yeah, everyone that speaks about heat does sound like my mum. How are you? How are you in this crazy summer of ours where everyone's kicking off? Everyone's kicking off. The behavioural scientist said it would come, but, you know, you got people jumping off the pier at Bournemouth Beach. You got fucking, like, block parties turning into riots in Brixton, statue defenders, people flying banners. It's a bit mental. But, you know, let's just bear in mind that when I say mental, I mean, I've seen a few clips online. When I go and walk my dog, it's not that mental. But apparently you can't say that, you know, because Jess Phillips tried to say that. That don't get too upset about, you know, riots, because when you look outside your window, it's mostly all right. And people say, sorry, Jess, stop gaslighting our lived experience of this chaos. Welcome to the show. This is called What Most People Think, which is I, myself, am a disgusting, filthy, selfish, evil, heartless Tory and a racist, stupid, ignorant Brexit voter, depending on who you speak to. And the point of the show is we just look at current issues and just try and do what, you know, what Keir Starmer's trying to do is try and find what is the centre ground of British politics. What is the most common view? I'll explain. We do a thing called a cuss count every week. My good friend David Demain, as well as chatting with me about a few issues of the week, he updates me on how much I've been swearing. It's just become a thing of interest in itself. So we'll give you the rundown of episode 42. It was two arses, two arse, one batshit, 12 fucks, one fucked, 19 fuckings. So the fuckings are here to stay, it seems. I think that the fuckings are the new normal of swearing. One piss, three shits, one shitty, one twats, and a wanker. I think that obviously we're living through a tenser time. If we were to go back, for any swearing enthusiasts, if you go through the beginning of lockdown when everything seemed a little bit more scary but easy to understand, the swearing had gone down notably. We were in single figures across the board. But 19 fuckings is a good way to calibrate the mood as a country as any. I welcome also my patrons here, the people that help keep the podcast weekly and ad-free. And the VIP patrons get a guaranteed mention at the start of the show. So I always mention new ones. And it is Rob Keeley. And yeah, just Rob Keeley this week, VIP patrons. And there's certain benefits that go with that. If you're interested in supporting the podcast, we had our first ever Patreon-only podcast this week. And look, I've still got a full-length podcast out on the Friday. So I'm aware of what happened. People get the ump, don't they? If I do a Patreon-only podcast one, they go, oh, right, you've monetized it, you cynical bastard. And so I've deliberately made this week's podcast longer. This is the kind of way I'm motivated. Yeah, I've deliberately done that. Just to prove you wrong, I've given you something that you might want. And yeah, thank you for all your support there. There are a few things that happen on exclusively on Patreon. I've got a big announcement. And when I say big announcement, I say that it feels like that to me. I don't know if anyone else gives a shit. But I'm going to announce a date for another online new material gig. And I'll give you more details of that. But coming up on this week's show, I will give you these details in the middle of our chat this week. Because we've got Pierre Novelli, who is a comic, a political comic, a great satirist. He appeared in the first series of The Mash Report. He's a really great thinker. Do you know what I mean? Like, he's some of his analogies, and I'll be honest, I've tried to nick a few over the years. He just has a very interesting way of seeing things, but he's on the left, but he's not on the preachy left. And that's what draws me to him. I think it's a unique thing at the moment. A lot of comedy on the left can come across as quite moral and quite preachy and quite bombastic, but he's very considered and very accepting of other opinions. So I thought he'd be a great guest, and we had a really interesting chat and got into a lot of issues of the day, including the sacking of Good Morning Mrs. Long Bailey, who, you know, did the usual thing in Labour. You just like, oh yeah, I've read an article with some really controversial stuff in, but it doesn't seem controversial to me. I'll just retweet it. So yeah, we're going to crack on in a sec, because what I want to do before the chat with Pierre, I just want to share a couple of thoughts about where the left is at, which we'll also pick up on in the chat with Pierre. But just quick thank you. Thank you to Diet Coke. I love my corporations. I think that they do a lot for the planet. They keep so many people in work. They have great salary progressions. They're the biggest employers of young people. And during lockdown, I made a pledge to myself that I would drink one can of Diet Coke every day. And by God, I've fucking done it, people. Every single day. Sometimes I've left it. The other night, I drank one at 10 p.m. walking the dog. It's my thing now. I just drink a Diet Coke. And you know the hilarious thing is with it? Is that people get so upset about Diet Coke. I don't know what it is. They think that even people that take cocaine have said to me, you shouldn't be drinking that shit, Jeff. It's got a Spartan me in it. Spartan me is a state tool of oppression. And like, fucking, it just makes me a bit happy when I drink a Diet Coke. I'm not a big drinker. I'm a binge drinker, which is, you know, my patriotic duty is to binge drink. So yeah, I have a Diet Coke. Fuck you. And just a quick fuck you on why does no one seem to give a shit that COVID kills more men than women? I mean, like, I just wondering what the percentage would need to be of additional deaths that it would have to be before anyone give a shit. Because at the moment, you know, it's a good, you know, what if it's 90% of them were men? Because, you know, we're focusing on all other kinds of different communities at the moment. What about the male community? What are you saying, Jeff? You're saying you put on a bit of weight and you felt like you've had a bit of a cold this week? Yes, I fucking am. That I was already going to have today about what's going on with the left. What's going on with the left? Or, you know, it depends on how you say it. Or what is going on with the left? But I was going to talk about how, you know, Starmer has started well, certainly in the Commons. He hasn't really given any ideas of what he would do, but he certainly asked some good forensic questions. And then as I was getting ready to do this podcast, Rebecca Long Bailey sacked, as I mentioned, for this article that she retweeted. And, you know, he's got this battle to fight in his own party, right? Because you've got this situation where the membership have liberal values from the year 3000, a lot of them, they're off their fucking heads, right? If there's any of you listening, come on, man, you've been to the conferences. But, you know, you had Dawn Butler recently making her comments about the British police having their knee on the neck of young black and Asian men and women in this country. And, you know, it's quite a visceral image to use. And then of course the issue with Rebecca Long Bailey and Starmer has a problem here, because it's only a couple of months ago where he took power and his job, and everyone agreed that it was his job, was to win back the Labour heartlands, right? That was it. That's all you got to do. On the night of the 2019 general election, I was there doing Channel 4's alternative election. It was all about, you got to win back the heartlands, right? And then when Keir was in, that's what you got to do. It's all about fucking heartlands, you know? And people are probably getting annoyed now thinking that's a Yorkshire accent, Jeff. But it suits what I'm trying to say. Win back to fucking heartlands. Open pits. And he hasn't, you know, and then within a couple of months, obviously, with some of the issues that have hit the public eye recently, the left seems to have become a cause-based movement now. If you look, that makes sense, right? These young people, maybe there's a certain pragmatism to it. They sort of where it's looking increasingly hard for Labour to ever win a majority in a general election. Maybe let's just do this on a cause by cause basis. So, by the way, if you can hear that outside, that is some of my neighbour's kids. You know, it's strange, you get older, people say, oh, is there anything better than the sound of kids playing? I'll go, yeah, kids not playing. But it's become a cause based movement. The left, and what happens now is the cause comes up, you know, they try to make it trend, they try and lean on the party in power and also the opposition to support it, they get a win. They move on. But what is seeming to be happening is the adoption of identity politics seems to be gathering pace at the moment. You know, like it would seem to be that to win back the Labour heartlands, the thing you'd have to do most was talk about domestic politics and things that matter to those people, to kind of square the Labour Party again, once again, as a party of law and order and a party that loves the Queen, you know, love the military, and they, you know, they don't. They've never been further from that. And we're importing, it seems, you know, US-style identity. Do you remember when they were saying, like, chlorinated chicken was the worst thing that you could import from America? I'd argue, based on the last few weeks, there's a lot fucking worse. And, you know, they seem to have very little to say about things. You know, the terror attack Do you remember that? You know, ages ago. Oh, yeah, sorry, that was last Saturday. That was last Saturday. There's three people stabbed to death in Reading. And there's been precious little said about it on the left. We've had more said about a fucking someone flying a banner. We're still having the kneeling at the football. Fair enough, you know, like collectively, football's decided to support Black Lives Matter. But we didn't have a minute silence, as far as I know, for the terror attack. And that just seems like... It seems to lack balance. That's the main thing, right? It seems to, on the left, there seems to be an imbalance in to the things that they give a shit about and the things that they don't give a shit about. There was a time, not so long ago, when a terrorist attack against an apparently group of gay men would have been the first up the list. You know, gay men, very protected identity, you know? Gay men and the left, right? It's like, they go together, like, you know, gay men and the left. And I think the thing about the far right, maybe this is the point I'm getting to, is that, fair enough, if the young left as a movement have sort of said, well, we haven't known a Labour government in our lifetime. It seems like it's impossible now. We're just going to go to a cause-by-cause basis. There is, grudgingly, a certain common sense about that. What I think is a problem at the moment is you look at these twats on the far right, okay? You look at these people that want to stir hatred and want to, you know, fake photos and videos to get people even angrier. All they need, right, all these people need is a narrative. And the easiest narrative of all to give the far right is when you deploy double standards or when things happen that you technically should give a shit about, but you gloss over because you've got your own pet interests which aren't balanced out with the interests of the wider country. Okay, welcome to the podcast for the first time, Mr. Pierre Novelli. Hello, Pierre.
Hi, Jeff. How are you doing?
I should say you're down the line here, which is my way of excusing the fact that I'm doing this over Zoom and I haven't looked into ways of doing it better than just having the volume coming out of my laptop.
I think there's some fancy websites you can synchronize things on and stuff, but...
I'm 43, you know. Mate. I'm 43. The good thing is that one of the problems I've had is that some of the people sound a bit tinny, but you are naturally got quite a bassy voice, so I think you've done some of the graphic equalization for me here.
Oh, nice, yeah. Cut a bit of editing work out of it.
Yeah, well, I sort of sound like I'm flirting already, don't I? Like you, on the other hand, you've got a really lovely bassy. You're tall, you know. You're what a man should be. So, just quickly, obviously, I think you know some people are interested in what's been happening with comedians in lockdown. Have you done any of your online gigs at all? Have you flexed your muscles that way?
I haven't done online gigs. I've done some streaming stuff and I've kept on with podcasting, but I haven't done a Zoom gig yet.
I did one for the patrons, which I like to use any excuse to bring up just to remind people that there will be another gig soon and they can be part of that action. But it was better than I thought. And I did it sat down. I think the key is to take the stakes out of it because if you're sort of standing up, and wearing a suit, I think it just feels a bit sad. It feels like, you know, one of those blokes back in the day when they had like recessions and depressions that carried on going to work just because he couldn't bring himself to let his wife know that he was just sitting on a fucking bench. So we worked together on the MASH reports. Just to give people like a bit of a steer, so your kind of political orientation, where I've got an idea of where you are on the political spectrum, but I'm not entirely sure.
So I would say just... If it's going to be like a generic summation, kind of just left of centre progressive, but not a Corbyn voter,
no,
either. So that kind of slightly tricky.
Is this a very Lib Dem way of saying Lib Dem?
Well, that's the problem. Is that I'm intermittently more in favour of state solutions than the Lib Dems, but I do think you should legalise weed, so, you know.
Yeah, I mean, look, let's be honest, I'd say state solutions currently a lot more likely than legalising weed.
Yes, I think that the only way that they're going to legalise weed now is if it became, I don't know, it was pitched to some kind of British underdog cottage industry.
Yeah, or it could cure COVID. That would be the only way. Why is that, do you think? I've often thought, is it just the Brits are just a bit too immature? Because what will happen is the first politician or prime minister to even sort of broach the subject is going to have a joint photoshopped onto their hand and they'll be on the front page of the Sun. That is...
Yeah. Yeah, and they'll have like a word like bifter or roach or something like inserted into their name as a pun.
Yeah, it'd be a really bad pun as well, like Boris Johnson.
Oh. Yeah. Rasta Sunak. Yeah, exactly. It would always be something a bit not a naff like that. But I don't know. It's strange because in theory, a lot of people who are currently in power should be in favour of it in terms of their favourite topics of personal responsibility.
Yeah.
And it's something you can tax the hell out of, and it is one of the few recreational drugs that makes people sit quietly at home.
Well, we could do with some of that right now, with some of the current...
That's how it cures coronavirus. Everyone's too stoned to get up off the couch.
It just turns everyone into fucking hermits.
Yeah, exactly.
We've cured coronavirus. Everyone's too scared to leave the house. There was some talk that apparently tobacco, like they're finding that people who smoke tobacco were more resistant to COVID, which was kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that they were very worried about smokers and asthmatics, and not initially so much about diabetics, but it's way more diabetics have been dying. Smokers have got quite good outcomes.
Do you think it's because smokers have always got like smoke bubbling? It's like some sort of protection. They've always got stuff in their lungs. It's got to get past that.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it lives in the alveoli or whatever, the little sacs, then if the sacs are already full of tar, there's nowhere for it to go, I suppose.
But that is just the kind of belligerent philosophy that a smoker is always on the lookout for. See, not only are we propping up the country, we know what we were doing.
Yeah, it would be a Bill Hicks bit if he was alive.
Yeah, it's been a while, but I think he is finally validated. And. I've always enjoyed your take on politics. I particularly remember that bit you did on the MASH report, which was about Syria. And I remember that the angle of it was how can I not give a shit about Syria? And it was, you were talking to various kind of learned people, but the angle was that you just didn't want to think about it because it was too scary and upsetting. And I thought that where, I knew that you were left of centre, but I thought what was different there was you weren't trying to take a morally high status thing. You were sort of thinking, this is how people think, you know, this is a more honest appraisal of where we're at. And I would say that currently, you know, with left-wing political comedy, that's quite rare on your side of the fence, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, I mean, my line of thought was that we're determined not to do anything.
Yeah.
And it's worse to know if someone is being murdered and do nothing than to not know, because at least then you could say you didn't know.
Yeah.
Whereas instead, we know it's going on. Yeah. We're just determined to not fucking do anything.
I've often thought that if you detach completely, there is a sort of moral absolution that goes with that. And I have this theory about something called a mix between kind of optimism and apathy. Aptimism, whereby you just admit that you're going to not do anything and hope it'll be all right. And I think that is more common than we like to admit.
Well, that's it. And also the fact that so many people refuse to accept that engaging with the world and bothering to do things comes with risk. So I'm not just talking about something like, say, a no-fly zone so they can't gas their own people.
Yeah.
But I'm also talking about taking in refugees. Like, you need action on both ends.
Mm.
You've got to deal with the people while the thing is happening. You take people out of the house while it's burning down, put the fire out, they can rebuild it, and then move back in. But what I don't like is people who make a big thing out of talking about how horrible it is, but they aren't in favour of any particular solution to the problem.
Yeah, and that is a problem, isn't it? When we look at social media as the home of political discourse, it's a kind of rolling message board for exactly that sentiment, isn't it? What I think has changed recently is just how quickly it moves on from things. Things that seemed like such a big deal, you know, even something like Cummings, for example. I mean, as much as people want to pretend that they're still angry about that, it feels like from another era.
One of the other problems with the stuff like the Cummings thing is that everyone's realised now that the most powerful thing you can do is never apologise, never explain, never resign.
Yeah.
Because if you apologise, then that means you think you did something wrong. And if you did something wrong, you should resign. And if you resign, well, you must have done something wrong, or else why would you have resigned?
Well, I think that might extend to comedy as well, with the sort of fake apologies in comedy, because I often think that we're, in a perhaps less cynical way, if you apologise for a joke that you don't think honestly think there was anything wrong with, you're kind of opening the gates of hell, because then you're sort of saying, yeah, I did mean that. You know what I mean? You know when I did that joke, or you know when I said that insensitive, I was actually what you said I was. And the problem is the people that are accusing you won't have any more respect for you, and they'll just move on to the next thing. And then the people who respected you will then think, well, great, now I laughed at your racist joke.
Yeah, exactly. You've undermined the whole thing, and that's what happens when, in terms of society, so we're talking about society when it comes to jokes. It's like groups of people getting along. It's a lot of the things like saying something offensive or fucking up. You can't have Christianity without forgiveness, right? That's how it's sold. It's like, yeah, you can sin, but don't worry. There's a whole way out of this.
Mm.
There's stuff you can do. Whereas if all you have is hell, it's not going to, you know.
That's good, yeah. It's good. That's a really good analogy. You're very good at these sort of these big tent ideas. I remember there was one, we were speaking at Edinburgh, and we were speaking about the American approach to tax and why the American right was different to the British right. And I don't know if I put you on the spot here, if you remember it, but you made an analogy about pie.
Oh, God.
I mean, if you've forgotten it, I'm going to have that and I'm going to fucking run with it for the next... In fact, no, actually, I've just remembered that was me.
That was you that said that. Yeah, yeah. What was it you said? Most
people think. Well, we were talking about like, you know, a growing economy, and a socialist will say, let's keep the pie the same size but give poorer people more of the existing pie. Whereas, a British capitalist would say, let's make a bigger pie and then everyone just gets more pie naturally. Yeah. And an American would say, why the fuck does anybody get to have free pie?
Yeah, there is. See? There you go. Yeah, hey.
It's pretty good, isn't it, Pierre?
Yeah. Write these things down.
A lot of people at my tour now are going, that was what you opened the last tour with. I don't know why.
Wait a minute. That was the Jeff Knockout Pie Tour.
But it was an interesting point, because I think at the moment, particularly, where we are drawing a lot of kind of imperfect parallels between British and US culture, there's not even a perfect parallel between the US and the British right, is there?
No, I mean, the US right is so different. I mean, we're getting bits of it bleeding over into the British conservative culture, not least because the Tory party seems to send a lot of its interns over to the RNC and stuff to pick up the latest tricks or whatever.
Hmm.
But yes, fundamentally what the US right doesn't have is that kind of one nation Peter Hitchens style conservatism, where it's like even Peter Hitchens is sitting there going, well, of course the government should run the trains. Otherwise it could be run badly and we won't own it anymore. It's kind of a much more centralized government, like paternalistic form of conservatism, where it's like the government's job to preserve the country actively with its resources, as opposed, from what I understand. I mean, like, I don't have a degree in politics, but from what I've
conserve. To conserve. Yeah.
To conserve. Well, yeah, to conserve. And to the American seems to be conservative only socially, really, because they want to chop down forests and drill everywhere and burn everything down and sell it to McDonald's. And it's the opposite of conservation.
I think at the moment,
serving anything, they just eat.
Well, drill, baby, drill was the famous, and it was. I remember when Sarah. Do you remember when Sarah Palin said that? There was something about it that I found quite appealing, because I am like part knucklehead, like things like that. Do a bit. I'm like, yeah, fuck yeah, drill, baby. No one ever gonna tell me not to drill. So I can be. I can understand. This is maybe where I always sit. Is I sort of straddle that divide where I totally get why that fuck you sort of. Let's just go for it. You know, let's not, instead of worrying about the planet that's probably going to die anyway, let's just have a real good time on the way there, you know?
Well, that's the difference, is that in the US, stuff like, you know how in the UK a lot of quite conservative organisations or organisations that are very popular with the Tories will be like the Countryside Alliance and like the Bird Watchers Association of Lower Thrimbley or whatever the hell. Like, those wouldn't be, you know, in the US, it would be the Republicans saying, fuck the bird sanctuary, let's highway right through it.
Let's eat those birds. I bet they taste amazing.
Yeah, whereas here, that's a conservative thing, and there it would probably be seen as some kind of, I don't know, parochial hippie nonsense.
Speaking of parochial hippie nonsense and Twitter, I was thinking about this week about I opened the show talking about it, but about where the left is at, and that it seems to be becoming a cause-based movement now, I think. There doesn't seem to be like a realistic play to the idea that they could ever win a majority. And it's now like a movement. And a pressure group. Is that real? Is that just pragmatic? I don't know if there's a certain sense in it.
Well, what's interesting is that you must know. I was talking about exactly this with Alex Keeley, who's
very good guy, very funny
political stand-up, and it was basically like, in terms of pragmatic winning an election, right? If Labour want to win the next election, not win anything in Scotland, if they want to ignore Scotland and win the next election, they need to also take Rees-Mogg's seat. Like, that's how much they need to cut into
North Somerset.
Yeah, yeah.
Good luck, Labour. Yeah, yeah.
But here's the thing, right? So on one end of it, you have all the cause-based stuff, the activism and so on, which doesn't even try or think about elections. Whereas on the other side of it, Keir Starmer on Victory in Europe Day was on the front page of the Daily Telegraph accusing the government of fucking over pensioners.
Yeah.
I mean, that's on target for that kind of a floating voter or voter that you need to win over. And in theory, the cause-based stuff on the left could just be like UKIP. UKIP didn't win shit, but they've changed the entire course of British 21st century history.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a really good point. And maybe because we always write off these left-wing activists as being a bit deluded and a bit stupid, but they've sort of seen through social media that they can push around the establishment because corporate policy and governments are just, for whatever reason, terrified of trending in this tiny echo chamber.
Well, but the main thing to remember is that regardless of the truth of the matter, in any case, if you take two groups, and one group is suggesting something like, you know, cancel the army. There won't be an army ever again.
And I think that's the Green Party's official line, actually.
I think it is, yeah. And then you have another group that seems a bit more sort of suit and tie, and they're saying, no, we'll just change the way that we recruit the army.
Yeah.
Everyone will be so afraid that the craziest one will win that they'll probably endorse the middle one, if only to stop the crazy one from happening.
Yes, yeah.
So, for example, if a load of crazies are saying we should just delete all the EU treaties immediately, a bunch of people arguing for a referendum are going to sound pretty reasonable. So you need the crazies to shift the thinking further along to the more sensible option.
Well, yeah, that is, I mean, what's called the Overton window, right? The way that the centre ground of British politics can get moved. I suppose Corbyn did have some success in that, and a lot of people now think you should nationalise the trains, you know, if you hadn't been a sort of anti-Semite and absolutely terrible politician. He, you know, who knows? He could have gone somewhere. So just a quick hype here. First up, saying hello to some of my £5 Patreons, Usman Qayyum, Danny Bushell and Julian Smart. And I hope you enjoyed the one-off Patreon only. Well, it's not a one-off. I might do it again. It was fun to do. So speaking of benefits, being on Patreon, like the odd Patreon-only episode of the podcast might drop. Do you ever get to say drop about anything that isn't a rap album? People say that now all the time. Yeah, the new series of Broadchurch has dropped. I'm like, well, has it got Jay-Z in it? Now, I think only Jay-Z gets to say that it drops. But I'll be looking at doing, I'm going to do another online new material gig. And that is going to be next Friday. I'm announcing it now, like it's a big deal to fucking anyone other than me. But I don't get out much at the moment. I'm doing a new material gig. I better write some new material. That'd be one sensible way to approach this. But yeah, the 3rd of July. And as before, it will be automatic access to front row for VIP £10 patrons. That means that you get to actually sit. I can see you. You can see me. We can chat to each other. All £5 patrons will be able to watch the gig. And then I'll pick 15. Based on my hosting thing, I might be able to pick a few more than 15. But as a minimum, I'll pick 15 of the £3 patrons, and you can see a man sitting in his house, desperate for approval. As we speak, Rebecca Long-Bailey has been fired from the Shadow. I think Shadow Health Minister, was she? Education Secretary.
Yes, that was it, yes.
And it's partly because she retweeted an article with Maxine Peake in which she sort of just endorsed Maxine Peake as a good person, but the article had contained within it some fairly standard hard left, you know, stuff like blah, blah. If you don't vote Labour, you're a Tory.
Yes.
You know, something, something Israel. And, you know, the, yes, the usual stuff. Now, knowing Rebecca Long-Bailey, I think there's every chance that she just retweeted this without reading it, which is arguably just as worrying. But does it, yes, now open up this fight in the Labour Party, i.e. the divide between what Starmer knows needs to be done to win an election and what all, the majority of the membership want and what a lot of the MPs want? There's a big gulf between those two things.
Well, the terrible irony of all this is that as much as my friends who were like, I've got friends who are like fully paid up Momentum activists,
yeah,
full on Super Corbyn fans, and they like to refer to Starmer as whatever, centrist, Tony Blair, whatever. He's way more left wing than that. He's not.
Yeah, he is.
He's,
yeah,
not progress. He's not, as in the part of the Labour Party, he's not right wing Labour at all. And he's also, you know, a working class boy done good.
It's tricky though, being called, I know that he has come from, you know, reasonably humble background, but he is still called Sir Keir Starmer. That's a tricky one,
well,
isn't it?
Well, this is the thing about the British class system is that, you know, Corbyn went to a private prep school, yeah, and then a grammar school, but he had a beard and liked to make jam, so he seemed nice. But Keir Starmer wears a suit and is a knight, so he sounds like the villain in a film.
And he actually earned, you know, he earned that title. It wasn't like hereditary or anything.
He took on News International. I mean, this guy's throwing mud in Rupert Murdoch's eye. How much more could you want? For representing unions for free, he's the real deal. And yet everyone's very upset at him because he's going to have to, like you say, try and make things a bit more palatable to the general public. But he's not significantly more right-wing. That's the mistake people are making.
But he looks right-wing, Pierre. This is how the left-wing works.
Yes.
That's not an argument. How dare you?
Looks right-wing.
Look at his hair. He's got right-wing hair. He's got...
That is right-wing
he's
hair.
He's got Republican hair. It's even worse than that. This is, you know, this is... this is a problem. It's this chasm. And I did think, and I've variously lost faith with this still. You know, you make a bold political prediction. They're very easy to make. Usually people forget them. But when the Brexit referendum result happened, I said that I think in the long term the Labour Party are going to split. And then for a long time it seemed like the opposite, that it would tear apart the Tory Party. But the Tory Party's, yeah, love of power can trump most things in the end, right? They eventually will get back together. I just don't see how it can hold, because like the moment, you know, someone like Starmer tries to take a more sensible line, you know, you get the divisions, but then if you err back towards a very left-wing character, then they're not electable. I don't know if that'll ever fix itself.
I think one of the things that's going to change and help make Starmer's job a lot easier is that a lot of the hard left people want him to have like big government policies, right?
Mm.
And they'll be annoyed if he starts doing things like, oh, we'll outsource that to, you know, Capita or whoever, because that's what Tony Blair did and blah, blah, blah. And it's private companies making money. It's not the government. It's not the state. However, because of coronavirus, we've just had an in-practice demonstration of everyone in the country either seeing big state power work beautifully, or not be like the state not being powerful enough. We've had cases where the public are desperately demanding enormous state intervention, huge government salaries, magicked out of nowhere for people while they can't work. Essentially just centralized big state power. And everyone's gone, oh, we've been told since the 70s that this just leads to corpses in the street. But it turns out it led to a few grand in my bank account while I'm unemployed.
Well, it does seem it could lead to a few cars on fire, but that is a slightly separate issue.
Yes, well, it's probably better for the environment to burn them now than let them keep going.
But where, you know, where this power that's got through social media, people are used to now getting victories on things. You know, if you can get things to... There was a period, actually, where not many issues came out of Twitter. Like, Me Too is a good example of something that worked very well, and then there's a period where not many things came out. But now, recently, there's been a real glut of things that have come off social media. One of the issues is that there's a real lack of overall consent for these things. So, you know, like, I think, 13% of the country have got a Twitter account. A much smaller percentage of those are active, and a much smaller percentage still are involved in discourse. So this, we're in a strange time where a Brexit referendum that really did have, you know, huge engagement and an actual democratic mandate was, you know, not accepted widely for quite a long time. And whereas ideas that crop up on social media can quickly become, you know, policy quite quickly. Is there an issue with, like, consent here? Like, popular consent?
There's also a problem where So there's if an issue pops up on social media and that's how we hear about it, there's two different kinds. So there's the kind that pops up on social media just because it's some new thing from social media,
yeah,
and it's maybe brand new or flimsy or it hasn't been researched. Sometimes it pops up on social media because it is researched and it has been, you know, based on serious, you know, academic work and whatever, but it hasn't got the airtime. It just happens to have spread more easily through social media than it could have before social media, because who sends that email on, you know? So there's two different kinds. I'm generally speaking, I think you and I, because you and I, if Twitter is a bubble, you and I are in it.
Yeah.
And so we also think that these things become policy or are big and important. And we're also wrong from within the bubble in that.
Mm.
So when something does become policy, often it's something that that person was thinking anyway, and they've used Twitter as an excuse. But Twitter didn't make
them. But at least we're part of the dialogue. I think that sometimes things will arrive at the general population. And maybe I am thinking more, perhaps, maybe not policy as such, but debates, you know, like around trans issues and stuff like that. It arrives at the general public, having been the subject of furious debate online. And yet a lot of the concepts are very new to...
Oh, that's definitely true.
Yes, I mean, like, you know, just say men can have babies. Like that, to most of the population, they're like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like,
Well, that's definitely true. And I was talking with a friend of mine the other day, and I was saying that most of these concepts or like new terminology for stuff, like acceptable academic terms for different groups and things like that, they start in academia. That's where they're invented or where they're debated and discussed. And then I think the next place they seem to go down from academia is into the arts.
Hmm.
Into our industry, because everyone sort of goes, oh no, that's the new way to do this and do that.
Well, we love a buzzword like gaslighting, like the proliferation of gaslighting. It just feels like a cool word to say. It's like systemic at the moment.
Yes, and
it makes you sound smart, doesn't it?
Yeah, and a lot of it's not gaslighting is a very important concept, but people tend to use it just to mean general manipulation, whereas it's supposed to be manipulation of the idea of reality.
Yeah, it means like, you know, I've said something, you don't agree with me, and therefore you're gaslighting me. And just, if for some reason it sounds worse than straight up manipulation.
Well, I think that is true in the sense that, I mean, that when I speak to people, friends of mine who do, you know, normal jobs and live normal lives, they're not a comedian, they don't hang out with crazy joke tellers late at night on weekdays and things. They have to get up in the morning and so on. They are generally, you know, months or years behind the acceptable terms for this or that or new concepts or radical new ideas. I mean, this recently now what we're seeing is the American idea of defunding the police hitting people's minds.
Yeah.
Suddenly arriving on people's mental doorstep and everyone's going, oh, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
And having to come to terms with it. Whereas a lot of the people on Twitter talking about it are from academic or public research circles that have been debating the theoretical concept of defunding the police for years. So there's a real mismatch in
understanding. Well, when I said online this week that I think that it's one of those things that doesn't even sound right in a British accent. Like, because it kind of like, you know, like when British people say ass. Like, we can't say arse sounds way too British. Ass, we don't really have an arse-based word that actually...
I'll kick your arse.
Like, yeah, or like, you know, party. Like, we're in British people, we're going to really party tonight.
Party.
So it is both as a concept and just, you know, orally, it doesn't sound right. But I think people... It is strange because we're told, so, you know, across, like, from the liberal left for a long time throughout the EU debate, a lot of people saying we're... European, not British. And it turns out that culturally, we are a state of the US. Like, it's so obvious when you look at, like, the way that language and ideas can permeate. And there are, and I totally understand, you know, you look at the murder of George Floyd, and you look at the treatment of black suspects in the state, you know, it's brutal, and you have a reaction to it. But now, this become part of the daily kind of diet of this country, and the distinction of it being a different country doesn't matter to some people, and for someone like me, I find that unusual.
The difficulty we have is that if you look at the statistics, the UK's problem is slightly different, because I mean this was even in the Daily Telegraph, I think we have worse death statistics for black people once they're arrested.
Mm.
And in a way, you could argue that's more worrying because that means that they're being chucked in a cell and they're not being given medical attention and stuff. It's when they're in the care of the state.
Yes, yeah.
So then you've got someone saying, hey, I'm epileptic, I need my medicine. And you've got some thug in a corridor saying, yeah, I've heard that one before. And then just letting them die.
Yes, yeah.
Which is, so that's, there's a book written by a South African journalist where he talks about, as a white South African in the 70s, his sense that the cultural sun that the whites were sort of imprinting themselves on, flattering themselves that they were European and not African, was the UK. And in the 60s and 70s, it switched from the UK. It turned, like how he says, like a flower turning to the sun. And it turned to America. And then they were American, more like the Americans importing American ideas. And America does have this enormous cultural imperial power. So we will get our ideas from America long before we get anything from France.
I do think as well, you look at the power of American film and cult TV, like it doesn't show any power, a sign of abating. And I sort of got this theory, like we always thought that commodity wars, like oil and gold and gas would be the issue. But we're so addicted to American TV now, I can see a future where they withhold like series of box sets and stuff like that. And that it'd be used in trade negotiations, like just starve out the public for the next series of Stranger Things and see the people revolt.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Is that the UK is tremendously powerful in terms of soft power. Cultural stuff, like it punches way above its weight. Yes. It doesn't beat America, but it's disproportionately powerful. I was thinking, so in terms of the debate with stuff like defund the police, so I was speaking to a friend of mine who, we were talking about police funding and so on, and I didn't know this till the defund the police debate happened. So New York and London are roughly the same size.
Mm.
The Met police in London, their budget is about $1 billion a year. The NYPD's budget is $6 billion.
Wow.
So you get to the point where you think, that does seem... Are those badges actual gold? What the fuck are you doing? And then you find that out, and then you find out how many people they, you know, shoot in the face. And you think, yeah, maybe the money isn't helping.
The budget amplifies the anger, you know, when you look at what it costs you, when you look at that pie chart of what your tax money goes to.
Yeah, and we're very uncomfortable with the phrase defund the police, but we're fine when people say, yeah, we're not going to increase education funding in line with inflation.
But that's austerity, my dear boy. That's different. I mean, I'm comfortable with that.
Well, this is the interesting thing. So if you look at the LAPD in Los Angeles, they have had their budget increased by something like 7% a year every year for more than a decade. I mean, enormous. They've never stopped being funded, double inflation rates. Yeah. Just huge, huge, huge.
But there is a limit on that. And I think with the...
It's an election winner.
With the NYPD as well, I mean, there was that period when we were younger where New York was the murder capital of the world, and it really isn't now. But it's amazing sometimes how things just go unchallenged. So it may be that they're... Where is the murder capital of the world right now?
I think...
I mean, it's not like European City of Culture. I mean, you don't bid for it by just like just knocking off loads of tramps.
I imagine it's somewhere like Juarez or Rio or Johannesburg.
Yeah, Rio and Johannesburg comes to mind. But
El Salvador was the worst country for a bit, but they were having a civil war at the time, so that doesn't really, that's not quite the same.
Well, that's like the difference between COVID deaths and excess deaths. You know, there's all sorts of slides there that they could use to. But actually, if you look at the amount of people shooting people in the face at point blank range for no reason, that's actually gone down. If you take the Civil War out of the equation. I mean, one thing about you, Pierre, is like you are a thinker rather than a feeler as a comic. Like, you're a rational person.
Unfortunately, in life, that is true for me.
Yeah. No, but I don't mean that you don't feel, but like you don't let sort of emotions guide your art form. But that's unusual quite often on the left in comedy. And does that get frustrated? Because, you know, if you bang the desk and did a rant, you know, people tend to like that because we live in quite an identity-driven age. People want to hear... It's the same for me as well, mate. Like, people sometimes get frustrated with me. They want me to say more right-wing stuff than I say, or they think that I'm pussyfooting around an issue. And the truth is, I'm just trying to say exactly what I think.
Well, that's the problem, is that if they want some kind of cathartic, rabble-rousing, you know, like a end of a movie thing, then, yeah. I mean, you can get that, you can buy that in the entertainment marketplace, but the very fact it's being sold to you as entertainment should let you know just how much use it is.
Yes, well, that's interesting you make that. So you see, like, that kind of stand-up as...
It's all entertainment. It's all entertainment.
Yeah.
I mean, how well do you think the punk rock movement did at preventing Reagan and Thatcher?
Well, yeah, and it is that weird. Have you seen the Batman Lego movie? Sorry, slight like side base thing.
Yeah.
So you know that they acknowledge him and Joker acknowledge their complicity. I think that there was such a truth at the heart of that, and we all have to admit is that every day, particularly like. You know, I do the outrage thing sometimes because I do get, especially in the morning, I get fucking outraged in the morning. By lunchtime, I could see the same story and not give a shit.
and look, there's a time for sides. I mean, you know, 1939 to 1945 was a time for sides. Let's make no bones about that.
Against the obvious fascist Winston Churchill, right?
Well, yes, indeed. Yes, so there is a time for sides. A time does have to come where you don't take it anymore, and you make no provisions for the enemy, that kind of thing. But one of the problems is that fundamentally, anything other than a rant isn't as satisfying. And if they wanted the data, they could probably find someone with the data who. That's what journalists used to be for, and now it's kind of. Comedians like John Oliver's show Last Week Tonight is half really good investigative journalism.
Hmm.
Because we've reached this point where political comedy has also got to have this almost bringing the facts to your attention sort of aspect, which used to be Bremner, Bird and Fortune and nothing else, and no one watched it.
Yeah. Well, it's and a kind of ego in a way that... My view with it always was like, do I have a good point? If I feel like I've got a good point, I'll work hard enough to get a good joke that allows me to say the point. But if I don't have, you know, if the point's really good, the joke could get away with being not quite as amazing and vice versa. But if it's just a point, I wouldn't say it. And I wonder sometimes maybe that's helping me out. Maybe my shows would be more satisfying as an hour if I went there. But I have a problem, and I don't know if you share this, taking moral stances. I just don't think anybody in the world wants to hear from that from me. It's not, I'm an individual first and foremost, so that's not how I see the world. So when, you know, when things come up on Twitter, whether it be about, you know, sexual harassment in the workplace or whether it is about taking the knee and stuff like that, I just don't chip in because I think, well, it feels bizarre to me. I don't know where you stand on that sort of thing, not those issues, but taking moral stances.
Well, I mean, there is a lot of truth in the idea of I'm not the spokesperson for whatever this is.
Yeah.
So, yeah, retweets, sure, but I don't need to put out a statement. I'm a clown. I'm an unemployed clown.
Well, this is what... Yeah, it's just statements, I suppose. Because every once in a while, I'll see something that I think is close enough to the way that I would express something, or, you know, and I'll retweet that. One of the ways I like doing is a podcast, because I always think at least... If someone's going to bend me out of context, they've got to really put in the work. Like, they've got to download it first. And then they've got to willfully misconstrue my tone. Whereas tweets, are, you know, it just... The importance of them, given that they're things that we often think of while we're having a shit.
Yeah.
Like, the fact that you could lose your job, like, seems bizarre. Because, you know, they're these throwaway thoughts where sometimes you don't really think about, like, the wider... You go, blah, 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 blah. There you go. And they held up as these tomes, like this kind of like mission statement.
It's also the difference in like, so we haven't kind of collectively decided what the internet is, right? So is the internet your toilet, like your front room, or is it the town square? Because if you shout the word fuck in your own house, that's fine. But if you scream the word fuck in the town square next to the group of 5-year-olds on a school trip, that's less fine. So which is it? And that was one of the main things with when people are like, if you put up like an offensive YouTube video, right?
Yeah.
If you do something offensive in your own home and someone walks past and sees it through the living room window, that's kind of almost their problem. Don't look in my window.
Yes.
Well, this is it. But then if you see something like Twitter is screaming it in the town square.
Yeah.
where anyone could see it, and you know anyone could see your, you know, your balls hanging out your zip or whatever it is you're doing.
And you're backlit and
yeah.
projecting your silhouette out of your own house and into the town square. Yeah.
Well, this is it, yeah. Now it becomes a public problem, and now, you know, everyone else has got to get involved and tell you to stop doing that. So we haven't decided whether or not... the reason it's confusing is because you send the tweet out into the public from your private home, from privacy.
Yeah.
And we haven't figured out whether the origin or where it arrives is more important.
Do you know what, Pierre? I think that just demonstrates your ability. We had the pie thing, and now we've got the, is it your home in your town square, which is another routine you'll be seeing on my next tour, the pie and square thing. But, mate, it's been wicked to chat. I know that a quick plug for the podcast you do with Phil Wang, if you just describe what that is to us.
Yeah, it's called Bud Pod, and it's mostly us just talking about our weeks and what's been going on, but a lot of it is very stupid. We didn't mean for it to be toilet humor, but a lot of the stories we get sent in are pretty vivid, dramatic toilet stories. Me and Phil have discussed this on the podcast extensively. We wish it wasn't funny, but by God, it's just so funny. Because it's universal.
Well, I think, you know, and I think podcasts like that, and that's the support you make universal, is there's so much discourse at the moment. It's like, and I get locked into these things, and suddenly you find something that's just so like lighthearted. I mean, I listen to a podcast about Star Wars called Rebel Forces Radio, and it's weekly. It's Jason and Jimmy, and 2.25 hours, they just talk about Star Wars every single week for 2.25 hours. And it just... And from the moment they start talking, I just feel happier. And I think that's perhaps something I'd certainly recommend anybody listening to check out your guys' podcast. And it's a decent...
I guess for whenever this comes out, I'll probably have a Twitch stream by then. And I'm going to play historical video games and talk about history while I do it. And a bit of Call of Duty as well, because I'm only human.
Yeah, see, there you go. But I would certainly tune into that. So check out the Bud Pod, check out Twitch, and Pierre Novelli soon to be coming to Twitch and stuff. And, mate, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me, man.
Hey, so that was the chat with Pierre there. And like I say, check out his Bud Pod podcast with the great Phil Wang, and him appearing on Twitch at some point. Like a lot of comedians, we're having to find different ways of monetizing what they do. He's a lovely bloke. He's a funny bloke. You know, so support him in any way that you can. We just got a couple of letters here to read before we finish the show. Jeff, I've been listening to your podcast. Oh, this is a long one here. This is great, actually. I'm just going to pray-see this. This is from... Oh, pray-see. Get you, Jeff, eh? You wanker. What are you eating? Sourdough bread, are you? You can't. I'm going to leave that one in. It's awful, isn't it? I'm leaving that one in. This was from a few episodes about the man whose wife was spending a lot of money on coffee. This is when coffee shops were open. And she was just sitting there spending his money. That's right, feminists. His money, I'm presuming. All right. Or whatever housekeeping he was generous enough to give her. She's sitting down there down the coffee shop. She's throwing it down her neck. Gingerbread lattes. She's taking a piss. He has said that what she should do to resolve this frustration about them getting in debt over coffee would be to sit down and have a conversation about what they want as a family, goals and ambitions. Then as partners go through all the family income and expenditure and look at where all the money is going, how does that fit with both this guy and his wife's plans? If they want a better house, could they both spend more wisely day to day? The thing about this, Kevin, is I like the optimism of it. I think women are so smart that about, you know, halfway into the second paragraph of that, women have clocked exactly what you're doing and are already narrowing the eyes, you know, moving the neck to the side a little bit and realising that they are being policed or gaslit. They're having their money. They're being gaslighted by money. So I think that maybe you pulled that off at your end, Kev. Maybe you run a fucking tight ship with you and your lovely wife there. Or maybe you're just naturally both reasonable people. And maybe I am a steaming misogynist. But as he admits, Kevin, you know, when they have that chat, it could be a double-edged sword for some men who don't want to account for their own expenditure. Yeah, I know that. I know all about that, Kevin. What the blokes, the stuff comes through on the credit card. Happy Times Incorporated. I think we all know what that means. What most people think. So we're just doing one more letter here because this is already a long one. Eh? That's what she said. And so I got a letter from a lovely letter from Katrina here, but she's one of these people that feels like government aren't unlocking fast enough. And there's a lot of people that feel this way. We've sort of got, well, I'll read out what Katrina says first. She said, I'm comfortable with the idea that government can continue to dictate who I'm allowed to see and invite into my own home. Right? I think that that's been lost in here, isn't it? We've got used to the new normal of governments kind of policing very private things. This has never been the domain of government before. In your house, you can allow one parent who can piss but not shit only on a Monday and a Wednesday before 4 p.m. They must speak whilst facing the other way and drinking from a vacuum set. I mean, like, who the fuck are you? I didn't elect you to become a fucking doorman for the nightclub that is my house. Yeah, This is a stretch. And then the people that kind of like feel risk averse around coronavirus and the people that wanted lockdown to continue well into September, they don't understand that this is already like a fundamental imposition on people's liberties. I know that there is there is health considerations for the country, but there's also liberty in there somewhere. Remember that good old fashioned liberty? I feel like Natalie Portman in Revenge of the Sith, when these lockdown was originally announced and everyone seemed delighted about it, I felt like her when Senate Chancellor Palpatine takes emergency powers in the Senate and then she delivers that terrible line, "So this is how liberty dies," to thunderous applause. Okay, so that is the podcast for this week. It just remains for us to say hello to a couple of £3 Patreons. We've got Lucy Jones, Chris Osman, and Richard Burbage. Burbage. That's a cool name. Burbage. God damn it. He sounds like a character out of Dad's Army, doesn't he? Burbage! What you been doing, mate?
Oh, I don't know, Mr. Manwaring. I was just stuck in the cupboard.
God damn it, Burbage. The Germans will be along any minute. Just a review, a couple of reviews here. One from Hendon Steve. I feel like I know how to do Hendon Steve. Not Hendon Steve. Hendon Steve. Just listen to episode 42. You were on fire, mate. Funny, honest, self-deprecating and serious, all mixed in together. A brilliant, light-hearted escape from the tidal wave of woke speak. I actually prefer the episodes when you don't interview someone, as you have plenty to say all by yourself. Well, I just realised I disappointed you this week, Steve. It was a bad week to read out that review, but I tried to bookend it with a bit of politics at the start and the letters at the end to keep everybody happy. Is everybody happy? I'll miss approval, but I won't lie. So this is from a Sunderland fan. This is SAFC, so that would be Sunderland, right? The line that sums up our age. So it's a 5-star review. Just a reminder, I always read out the 5 stars. I was talking about Sadiq Khan, and I said he's a Twitter politician in a Twitter city. I've got to do this in a Geordie accent. Sorry, a Macam accent. I'm just losing people. Like I lost a black cab driver the other week. He's a Twitter politician in a Twitter city. Could I suggest a UK wide leaflet drop? I don't know where this accent's going. This is the worst. I'm just normally able to do this accent. Could I suggest a UK-wide leaflet drop of this statement to try and hammer home to the Twitterati twats that an ill-informed opinion doesn't become the truth just because it's been retweeted by 10 of your equally ill-informed mates? See, that's the way you get the Geordie accent. Mates. Amazing. Your mates. Retweeted. Strangely, a very modern word is a good way to get a hook on the Geordie accent. Retweet it. Retweet it. Retweet. Oh, fuck it. Anyway, I'll see you next week. What most people think.